Continuing now with the Psychic Detective Show, we have Jim Sutterfield on the line from Arkansas. How are you, Jim?
Pretty good. How are you doing, Jerry?
Pretty good. Let's talk a little bit about how you got involved in being a psychic detective. I mean, that's not on everybody's wish list, I don't think.
No, it's not exactly what I wanted to be when I grew up. Well, I've been a medium my entire life. And I was working as a medium up around the Chicago area for several years before moving back home to Arkansas. And when I moved back here is when I got contacted by Gail St. John. And I had worked on some criminal cases before up in the Chicago area, around Michigan, some couple around St. Louis. I never really knew exactly how they turned out because I was working with the families instead of police. But when Gail contacted me, she told me about the USPD, United States Psychic Detectives, and what her goal was for the team, and I liked it. So the first case we were working on was, of course, the case of the Gehring children, and that turned out to be a real good case for us because we were able to pinpoint their location within a month. And
you know, when you talk about this, as the listeners already know from our visit with Gail and Vicki, you guys are all in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
But I guess that's really distance. Is that important in psychic ability or not?
No, actually it's not. I've sat for people before I joined the USPD. I've sat for people all over the world, from New Zealand, Germany, Japan. It didn't matter. Matter of fact, one of the cases we're working on right now is in Nepal.
That's pretty far away. What's that about?
There's a woman that came up missing while hiking, and her sister contacted us. She came up missing in October, and they found some of her items on the trail, but the police don't have any leads. They don't have any clues. They really don't. They don't know where to start looking for her. So she contacted us.
Is that a different language there?
She speaks English.
Okay.
So it helps.
Yeah.
Because I definitely don't speak any other languages.
You actually have cases around the world.
Yes, we do. There's three we're working on in Japan.
In fact, are you thinking about going over to Japan for a little while? I know Gail might.
It depends on what they want to do. Right now, they're talking about bringing Gail over there, and that would be fine, however they feel like working it.
In Japan, the police authorities, I think, are pretty receptive to this, aren't they?
I think so. I don't see, they look at psychic ability quite a bit differently than, say, the American public does, or the general public in America does. And they don't have psychics or psychic detectives like we do over here. And their own culture makes them more open to it. So what we found is that they're extremely receptive. I mean, they were a bit skeptical right off the bat, but when we were able to give them details about the cases that they had us working on that the police had not released to the public, then they got real excited.
You know, you talked about the difference in cultures. You intimated, I think, when we started the interview, that you found out you had this psychic ability early on in your life. Is that true?
Yes.
And how did that manifest itself? How did you suddenly realize, hey, I have this?
Well, I didn't think that anything was wrong with me. As far back as I can remember, I could talk to people. You know, they'd come into my room at night, whatever. Well, my parents found me walking through the house, talking to people they couldn't see, and...
Oh, so while you were very young, you had visitors in your rooms.
3 or 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my family, being a very religious family, They freaked out. So they were not very receptive to it. I mean, I grew up in Texas. I lived in the South just about my whole life. And being psychic in the South is not a very popular thing to be.
Now, what is your feeling about your religion and psychic ability?
I'm glad you asked that because that's been a passion of mine my entire life. Because of growing up in a religious family and because of being an outcast, you know, and not knowing, then it set me off on a quest to find as much information as possible. So I've studied just about every religion there is, theology, philosophy, the whole nine yards. And what I have found is that it's hard for me to understand why psychics are looked at the way they are when it's in every religion.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll just give an example, because this is something that when I came across it, just floored me. We'll just take the Christian religion. There's one passage in the Bible that refers to the greater gifts of spirit. You know, teaching, speaking in tongues.
Mm-hmm.
Going down the list, it says the discernment of spirits.
Now, your family, did they come to accept you with this ability, or?
No.
never have, huh? This is probably one of the things, major problems that psychics run across, I think, is this cultural thing, especially here in the United States, I hesitate to phrase it any other way, but the predominance of fundamentalism.
Yes. That's one of the big hindrances to it. And we're a nation of skeptics.
Now when we talk about your ability as a psychic, what are we talking about exactly? I mean, can you tell what I'm thinking?
No.
Okay.
I don't have telepathy. I can't tell what a person's thinking. I can't get into their head. Usually, I mean, I can tell their emotions. And that's about it.
Sure, that's kind of like most of us if we're attentive.
Exactly. Everyone can do what we do to some degree or another. It's a very natural thing. The only difference is that with me, my own particular gifts are like remote viewing, the ability to see a different place that I haven't ever been before. I'm able to, what really helps with the USPD is I'm able to see crime scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see what happens, I can get descriptions of people, you know, I can tell what happened where in the house. And so that helps a lot.
So you're able to see distant places you've never been, like this case in Nepal. You may have been able to see the landscape there. I don't know.
Yes. And I'll just give an example of how that case has gone is whenever I was focused on it, I would see a hillside, and the more I focused on it, the clearer the image gets. And I could see that it was steep. I could see if there were some trees on it. And then if I went up to the top of the hill, I could tell where the trail was at, you know, and where she was located. And I could pan around like that and get a pretty good lock on that area. And then once I did that, the image shifts to something else. And then I do the same thing there. And the whole time I'm doing that, I'm taking notes down so that I can compare it.
So you literally are sitting at a desk or something, writing down what your vision is?
Yes.
And when you come back and read your notes, does that refresh that vision? I guess it does.
It'll bring it back to my mind. But the main thing that it does, and this is kind of unique about the way that Gail and Vicki and I work, is we'll all three do the same thing without talking to one another. And then we'll take our notes and we'll compare them.
How do they usually compare?
They usually compare really, really close. I mean, even for someone, I've been doing this my whole life, and it just amazed me how pinpoint accurate we were to one another.
I was talking to a friend of mine down in Houston today, a childhood buddy I grew up in high school with, and we were talking about psychic ability. And basically, he and I agreed that we don't really understand what's happening. Do you?
The best I can explain it, and being a medium, I guess it kind of biases me, because the main thing that I do is I speak to those that have crossed over. You know, I talk to dead people.
Yeah, and I want to get into that in a minute, because that's been a large part of the subject here for the show.
Right. And so basically any information that I get, I credit to them, to the ones coming through to me. They show me things that I can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that much different than, and this is the way I've explained it in several seminars, say you pull out of your driveway one morning, and every morning of your life you turn right to go to work, and this one particular morning something is just screaming at you to turn left. You turn left and you find out there's a horrible accident, you'd have been in the middle of it. You know, that's the kind of thing that happens to everybody, and they generally will pass it off. Well, they never stop to ask, well, who was that screaming at me? Who was that screaming at me? Why were they screaming at me, you know? Why me? And that's the kind of things that I've sat back over my life and I've asked.
And what kind of answers have you gotten?
Well, that's when they'll tell me who they are, where they're past, and they'll give me a little different details about their life.
So literally, maybe even when you were a young boy, as we talked about earlier in the interview, and you were talking to people in your room and around the house, and your parents and the others couldn't see them, you may have been communicating with the dead even then.
Oh, I'm sure I was. Because a lot of the stuff that happened back then I can remember. And a couple of one woman in particular used to come to me all the time. She came to me all the way up. I think the last time that she actually came to me was about 3 years ago.
You're talking about a woman who has passed away.
Yes.
Is on the other side, and she comes back to you frequently. And what happens when she does?
It's usually at a point where, for myself, I'm needing to make a decision, or I'm needing to go in a particular direction.
So, in other words, she's probably somewhat like a guardian angel.
Yeah, or a guide.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't make her decisions for us, but they can nudge us pretty hard in the right direction.
What's your connection with this woman, you think?
On that, I have no idea. That's something that's puzzled me my entire life. Now, I cannot even count the number of hours I've spent.
And she's given you no indication?
No. And what I've had to accept is that information is probably information that I'm not supposed to have for whatever reason.
When she communicates with you and others from the other side do this, do you hear a voice, or it's a thought pattern, or what?
It depends. A lot of it depends on the person. One thing I like to say is that when a person crosses over, their personality plus, because their personality is the strongest part of them. Okay? So, if they're a very loud person, if they're a very strong-willed person, I'm able to see them walk in the room and hear them talking and everything else. And that's happened before. Other times, they're very soft-spoken, and they'll actually speak through my guides to me. And when that happens, that's when I get symbols that I'm familiar with. It's kind of like a mental shorthand. And I say, okay, I'm seeing this, and this is what it means to me. You understand that.
And when we talk about, we're talking about victims of murders more than anything else, I guess. Sometimes maybe accidents, and they can't find the body. What is this important to the deceased person, you think, to have closure?
Yes, I think it is, I think that's one of the things that's really amazing about the Gehring case. I've said this several times, is that I don't believe that the credit necessarily goes to USPD. I don't think the credit necessarily goes to the searchers. I think it goes to all of them, but more than anything, I think it goes to those children. Because those children were strong-willed enough, they wanted to be found. So they came through to us. We were able to pinpoint a location. That information got to the searchers. The searchers went out there. And then even when they went out there, the dog broke away from the searcher and ran over to where they were. So to me, that's just saying, you know, they were extremely involved in it.
Now, hey, you mentioned dogs, animals. Do you think they have this sensory perception of spirits, or can you tell?
Oh, I have no doubt of it. I can't count the number of times that I'll be talking about, well, your dog will see them. You know, that's a good way to know when they're around, because the dog will stand there and he'll bark at someone you can't see.
Hmm.
You know, or, you know, a cat will be laying in the middle of the room, and all of a sudden they jump up and they run flat into a wall, you know, full speed. It's because they get spooked. So I'm convinced, you know, through all my research and everything, that they definitely can't tell.
Can you tell me, or have you concluded, what's happening on the other side? Is it various scenes, or is it one of tranquility, or what?
It's various things. And what I like to say is that we all create our own heaven or hell, in that if my idea of heaven is sitting on a riverbank with a fishing pole, then that might be where I'm at when I cross over. I've had people come across to me, and the image they show me is them sitting on their front porch swing with a glass of iced tea. You know, it's a very peaceful feeling. Now, on the other hand, say someone is someone who committed suicide, it's a completely different feeling.
Have you communicated to people that have committed suicide?
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit more about that.
It's easy to tell when a person has committed suicide or is responsible for their own death, because they'll usually be the first ones to come through, and they jump up and down screaming and shouting that this was their doing. that they have to take responsibility for it, nobody else. So I've come to realize that that is an imperative thing for them. In order for them to make progress, and in order for them to fully cross over or whatever, they have to do that. Because when you think about it, a person who commits suicide is someone who's thinking about themselves more than anything, you know, regardless of being drug issues or mental issues or whatever. It's a very self-absorbed thing that leads them to it when you get down the brass tacks. So it's not meaning to be crude.
The thing that it's come up before in the show in my mind, and I haven't had a chance to express it, Jim, but I'll ask you. It seems to me that perhaps some people on the other side aren't all that peaceful. I mean, maybe they're not happy. Or do they come to terms with everything?
And that's a very accurate statement. And it depends on the person. Some people don't have a problem at all with taking responsibility for things in their life, and they move forward, and they're in a very peaceful place very easily. Others flat refuse to take responsibility. They can't face up to things they've done in their lives. And they trap themselves in this little bubble. They're not happy. They're miserable. You know, to me, that's about as close to a hell as there could be.
And have you run across anybody that was unhappy and suddenly came to terms later, or is it you're just destined to be whatever it is?
Well, yes, I have. I've come across several who they hadn't come through for 2 years. And the client would come back to me after 3 years, and boom, the first person that comes through is this person. And all of a sudden, they're taking responsibility, everything's okay, they're with their family, everything's good. So what I've come to realize is that a person who's in that state or in that position on the other side, when they do, they're not trapped there. The only thing that traps them there is their own personality or their own choices. Once they step out of that, and they start making progress, then they get out of that bubble. The only one that puts them there by themselves is them. Nobody else does it to them, if that answers your question.
Well, in a way, it certainly does. So basically, you continue to grow on the other side, spiritually, ego-wise, emotionally?
Oh, sure. That's one of the main lessons that I've learned over the years, is that just because we cross over, you know, we are in a different form, that doesn't mean that we're automatically enlightened. You know, there's still work to do. And to be honest, up until I started working professionally as a medium and working with clients, I would be the first one to argue against things like reincarnation. And I didn't believe it at all until it came through in a reading.
Now let's talk a little bit about, is there more than one place over there, for lack of a better term? I mean, is there a heaven and a hell, or is it all just one dimension? Is it something different that we can even, I mean, I have trouble figuring out what's there.
The best way I could explain it is if I explained it on terms that we're familiar with. Where we're at right now, I'm sure that everybody listening, including yourself, knows some people that are just really negative, really down people. And they usually isolate themselves. They're usually off by themselves. They're not around anyone, if you understand what I'm saying. While others are very sociable, they're very outgoing, and they have friends and family around them and everything else. It's not because they're forced to be off by themselves. It's not because they're forced to have family and friends. It's their choices and the way they handle things. And it's the same thing over there. It's all the same place. It just depends on what they want to do with it.
Well, what are your feelings about, for instance, reincarnation? Is that possible?
Well, it's something that, like I said, I argued against vehemently for years and years and years. And then one day I was sitting with a client, and I always record my sessions and then give the tape to them so they can go back over it later. And I was talking to them, and I was talking about a young man that had passed, and he was years ago, and I was just rattling off the information. And all of a sudden, I said, and by the way, the boy has come back. And I stopped, and I stopped the tape, and I rewound it, and I played it back so I could hear myself actually say that. And first thought in my mind was, okay, whoa, I couldn't have just said, that's not me. So now I need to really re-look at things. So once I started re-looking at it, then now I firmly believe in it. I've seen too much evidence for it.
Does everyone come back?
I believe it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
On it. I do believe that everyone comes back when they choose to, how they choose to, depending on what they're needing to learn or whatever. The goal, of course, is to get close to God or whichever God or higher power you choose to relate to, is to get to that level. So a good way that I look at it is it's kind of like school.
Yeah, this place you're talking about is different than many people imagine what heaven or hell would be like. How about somebody that has a strong religious ethic, or could even be, it doesn't have to be Christian religion even. They get on the other side. Have you ever heard anybody say, well, I was surprised, I was shocked, do people have trouble adjusting? I mean, it seems to me if you were a devout person in whatever ideology you had, and you get over there, and it's not quite that way, seems like you might have a little problem.
I've had so many of them come through that were devoutly religious. And they were expecting St. Peter and the pearly gates, and they had it all figured out in their head. They come through, and they're like, wait a second, this was not what I expected. But it's better. You know, it took a little bit of adjustment. They were surprised when they got there. They were surprised that, wasn't St. Peter standing there. There weren't pearly gates, and there weren't a bunch of cherubs going around playing harps, floating around on clouds. Instead, they find themselves, out in the countryside, sitting on the porch drinking a glass of tea or whatever. So it is a little bit of acceptance period in there. And I think that's where other family members who have gone on before us really come in to play on that. They're very instrumental in helping us to adjust.
So in other words, you're convinced that once we pass away, relatives and friends are there to help you.
Oh, yeah, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
How about somebody's had a pretty combative life and they have enemies?
Well, I can give an example on that. There was a person that I knew that I really could not stand him in life. And after he passed away, it was probably about 3 or 4 months before he came through to me. And he wouldn't come through to me himself, but my dad came through to me. And he brought this other person through with him. I told him, no, I don't want this. And he said, son, you're going to sit down, you're going to listen to me. And so he said, look, he's come to terms with things, he's taking responsibility. He needs to at least listen and pass on the information to his family. So grudgingly, I said, okay, I'll do that. And it turns out that once he did start taking responsibility, then he was around his family, and they were able to help him more and more. The more responsibility he took, the more he tried to progress, the more help he got.
Let's talk a little bit more about the psychic detective. I appreciate you taking time to talk about the overall philosophy and feelings and experience that you have. But I imagine this psychic detective work when it works. And what I guess before we go any further, what is the success rate? Or have you ever tried to keep score?
I've never really tried to keep score. Our team, USPD, has only been together since October. And the first worked on just right out of the bat was the Garing case, and boom, within a month, we had it nailed. On other cases that I've worked on, my success rate was really, really good. And I've heard the same thing about Vicky, and I've actually seen Gail on Psychic Witness and Psychic Detective.
How do you deal with it when you're wrong? I mean, is there an explanation of why sometimes?
The explanation of why I'm wrong is all wrapped up in the one word, I. Because it's a mistake that I made.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I got bad information. It's not that they told me wrong. It's that I took it and misunderstood it, or I misinterpreted it. And that's why I need to step back. I need to go over my notes again and say, okay, where did I make a mistake? You know, where did I jump here?
Yeah, I from my conversation with Gail and Vicki Bulp, I got the impression that not everyone is really, communicative. A lot of them deal in clues and hints.
Yeah, they can be very close-mouthed about it. And that's where we just had to find different ways to go about getting information. If the murder victim or the accident victim isn't the one wanting to come through, then usually for myself, I'll call the family, and I'll talk to them, and I'll see who else comes through, and I'll try to get the information from them.
Well, you mean like another relative or somebody?
Because some of them don't care if they're found. You know, to them it's not important. It's not as important for them to be found as it is for the family to know they're okay.
Most of these murder victims, do they want retribution, or is it past that? In other words, if somebody killed me and I had the ability to come back to haunt them, I think I'd do it.
That has happened before. That has come through on cases I worked before the USPD. And one of the things, I gave them details about the case, and then I said, okay, now you need to sit back and just watch. You don't do anything. They're taking care of it themselves. Now you need to sit back, watch everything that happens, and more or less just be a witness to it. See what they can do. And the last case that I worked on before I left the Chicago area was a family in Michigan. And they called me to let me know that because of the information that I'd given them, the person that had killed their brother was being arraigned that week. So, some of them, I don't know if they want retribution as much as justice.
Well, that was my question. Is there justice on the other side as well?
Oh, yes. You either pay here or you pay there. But you don't get away with it.
We only have a couple of minutes left. I notice you do some speaking of seminars and things. I imagine since you started this psychic detective work, maybe you don't have as much time. You have a website, which we have a link to. What do you like to do?
I like to teach. That is my favorite thing to do. I like to be able to open a person's mind up a little bit, show them, prove to them that this is real, and then show them they can do it. Because once that happens, once a person catches on to that, it's like a light bulb comes on behind their eyes and the whole world changes colors for them. And they're a completely different person after that.
So in other words, as we wrap up our program on psychic detectives, if I read you correctly, Jim, you're saying all of us have this ability if we just pay attention.
All of us do, to one degree or another. That doesn't mean that you're going to see your great-grandmother walk through the door, and sit down and play a game of bridge with her or gin rummy or whatever it is. But it does mean that you'll be able to recognize the guidance when it happens.
Jim, we'll be checking back with you. We wish you much success. It's been a very interesting program.
Well, thank you, sir. I'm glad you took the time for us.
Thank you very much. Don't forget the Psychic Detectives. You can see it every Wednesday night on Court TV at 10 o'clock Eastern. This program was produced by Jane Swartley. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening, and cheers.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
It just didn't look like anything I'd ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.